Hello and welcome to Probable Causation, a show about law, economics, and crime. I'm your host, Jennifer Doliak. I'm an academic economist by training and the executive vice president of criminal justice at Arnold Ventures. My guest this week is Oandrula Dube. Oandrula is the Philip K. Pearson Professor at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. Oandrula, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jen. It's great to be here.
I should say up front, the usual disclaimer, that everything we say today represents our own views and not necessarily those of our employers. And with that, we can dive in. So today we're going to talk about your research on a cognitive behavioral training program and how it affects police behavior. But before we get into that, could you tell us about your research expertise and how you became interested in this topic?
Yeah, so I use tools from economics to study drivers of conflict and violent crime in countries around the world. And at the time I began working on this topic, I was increasingly becoming interested in understanding how psychological and behavioral forces can shape these types of outcomes. I became really fascinated by a research study on the Becoming a Man intervention, which showed how training youth in Chicago to think about the situations they were in differently could reduce their tendency to engage in violent behavior. And when I saw these findings that they had from this BAM study, I began to wonder, you know, couldn't we apply this idea to policing? You know, the headlines were riddled with cases of police officers using excess force in their interactions with civilians. So I, you know, really started to think about this idea of whether this could in part be a function of how officers think about the situations they're in, right? Because often officers are in situations that are ambiguous, where it's really difficult to know what the right interpretation is, and they have to act quickly, and they're facing conditions of stress. So could it be that those cognitive demands of those situations actually interfere with officer decision-making and contribute to these types of adverse outcomes? So that's when I began talking to Anuj Shah, who was one of the co-authors of the Becoming a Man study, and we teamed up with Sandy Jo MacArthur, who had spent over a decade running LAPD's training programs, to develop this idea.
Okay, great. Your paper is titled A Cognitive View of Policing, and it's co-authored with Sandy Jo MacArthur and Anuj Shah. And in this paper, you develop, implement, and test the impacts of a new police training program. So let's dig in a little bit more to that motivation for that you all had to design this new training program. And so you had seen these sorts of programs applied to other sorts of people before, but actually designing a new training program obviously is not easy. So say a little bit more about what led you all down this road.
Yeah, so I think for motivation, it's really helpful to think about some examples. So consider this following situation. Imagine a man with a gun call comes in over the radio, okay? And the officers rush to the scene. They get there a minute later, they start looking around and they see a guy in the alley. Okay, and the guy is shouting, and then suddenly the officers see a glint of something metallic in the guy's hand. You can see how the officers in that situation might easily jump to the automatic assumption that that metallic thing is a gun and respond with force. And sometimes it might be a gun, but of course that shouldn't be a foregone conclusion, because sometimes that glint might just be a beer bottle and the guy is shouting because he's inebriated, or it might be a cell phone that he's using to call for help. Now, you know, we can sit here and easily think through these types of alternative possibilities. But what decades of psychology research tells us is that it's exactly under these conditions of cognitive demands in situations that officers face, like stress and time pressure, that actually deliberative reasoning really tends to shut down and automatic thinking takes over. So our view is that, you know, these types of cognitive demands inherent in these policing situations can undermine effective officer decision-making and lead to a wide range of adverse policing outcomes, whether it's using excessive force, as in police shootings, or making arrests that are really not necessary. Now, if that's true, though, it also has a direct implication that training officers to better navigate these cognitive demands, to be able to systematically consider alternative interpretations of the situations they're in, so they don't just go with their default interpretation, should also lead to improvements in these outcomes. And so that's what really got us motivated to develop a training along these lines. And so we see this work very much as both a test of the idea that cognitive demands might play a role in contributing to these adverse outcomes, but also as a proof of concept of whether a training like this could actually help to directly ameliorate these adverse policing outcomes.
In the paper, you lay out a few different hypotheses for why police-civilian interactions escalate to an unnecessary arrest or unnecessary use of force. Obviously, this policy concern has been in the news and on our minds for many years or even decades now. So what are the various reasons people have suggested for why these unnecessary escalations occur? And then where does your training fit in among the possible solutions that people put on the table?
Yeah, so, you know, when you look at the current public conversation on what drives uses of force in police interactions with civilians, you see that there's a lot of discussion that this is something to do with problematic officers, you know, officers who enjoy hurting other people, officers who have racial bias, whether implicit or explicit, right? And certainly that's consistent with the large literature that shows racial disparities in policing. And then another set of hypotheses is that this really has to do with problematic policies, like maybe uses of force policies are just too lax, and there might be a woeful lack of accountability in even enforcing these fairly lax policies. And, you know, we think that these types of factors are likely to be very important for understanding officer behavior. But at the same time, it really seemed like they were also missing a critical ingredient. And that really has to do with the nature of the policing task itself. And the idea that policing is often going to be placing officers in situations that are stressful and require them to act quickly. And so we really wanted to focus and highlight and explore if these types of cognitive demands were playing a role in undermining decision making. And that's why we wanted to devise a training to help officers better navigate these demands, to understand the role of these cognitive demands, which were not being discussed as much in the public conversation.
So what do we know about the effects of other types of police training on real-world outcomes?
Yeah, so one area where we have really strong empirical evidence, including from randomized experiments that have been done, is around police procedural justice trainings. So these trainings emphasize rules of engagement and prescribe ways that officers should interact with civilians in order to do things like engender trust. So for example, a study by Emily Owens and co-authors Weisberg, Amendola, and Alpert from 2018 evaluated a training where supervisors talked to officers about decisions that they'd made in a recent situation. And in the course of the conversation, they asked the officers to reflect on their actions, but they also model principles of procedural justice to encourage officers to adapt these policies. Now, this study found very promising results, like a reduction in the rate at which officers made arrests for about 6 weeks after this conversation was held. So results like this were really important because they already suggested that intervening and training could be very influential. But at the same time, the focus of those trainings was different in the sense that they included a prescriptive element of how officers should behave, whereas some of what we were trying to emphasize with the training that we developed, called situational decision making, or SITD for short, is that training like this could be leveraged to increase deliberation in a more general sense without necessarily suggesting to officers what precisely they should do in a given situation.
I think people are often surprised, or at least my read of the literature is that we really don't know much about most police trainings and whether they work. Is that your read too, with this exception of procedural justice training where there's been a bunch of more recent research?
I think there's also some literature that suggests that some of the things that are, some of the other trainings that are recently being emphasized, for example, like implicit bias training, are not very effectual. And there's at best mixed results also on de-escalation training. So to the extent that there's been work that's been done in these other areas to explore what their impacts are, there hasn't been much consistent positive evidence, which is interesting because these are continuing to be very much emphasized in a number of police departments across the country.
Yes. Okay, so tell us about the situational decision-making training that you and your colleagues designed. What is it based on, and what types of exercises does it involve?
The training is really rooted in behavioral science and draws heavily from the psychology of decision-making. I would sort of describe it as having three components. So the first component is it trains officers to recognize the situations that are going to be cognitively demanding. Like, we do an exercise with them where we ask them to identify what triggers them, what triggers emotions like anger or frustration. And, you know, they'll say things like, well, when someone flips me off or refuses to show me ID. And then that's very useful because then they know that these are the situations in which potential challenges might come up. What sorts of challenges? Well, the second kind of key element of the training is we train the officers to actually be aware of certain cognitive biases or what we call thinking traps that they might fall into under these circumstances. And these are really adapted from cognitive behavioral therapy, where they're called cognitive distortions, or the psychology of judgment, where they might be called heuristics and biases. These thinking traps include things like catastrophizing, which is assuming the worst or most dangerous outcome in a situation, like assuming the man is holding a gun and not necessarily a beer bottle or cell phone. Or it could include things like overgeneralizing to this situation on the basis of past situations. And the third key element is we try to give the officers a set of tools to keep them from falling into these thinking traps. And a lot of that is about training them to make the most of whatever little time they have so they can rapidly develop alternative interpretations of these ambiguous situations that they find themselves in. And a lot of that actually centers around leveraging scenario-based training through the use of a technology called force options simulators. So in these simulators, officers are actually interacting with characters who are projected onto a screen, and they go into the simulation with everything that they carry with them on the street. So guns, tasers, OC spray. And in this way, they also begin to see how the different force options they have at their disposal are going to map onto their interpretation of what's happening in the situation. And then after they go through a scenario, there's a really extensive peer-led debrief in which they're asked, okay, so what did you think was going on in the situation? What else could have been going on in the situation? Did you notice this feature? Did you consider this other possibility? And so in this way, they really begin to see how there's many potential interpretations of a given situation.
So these simulators, are these common in police trainings usually? Is it something that was, you know, already in use by the police department that you were working with?
Many departments around the country do use force options simulators. And we worked with the Chicago Police Department, and at CPD, they did have a simulator, but they were using it in a fairly limited way, in the sense that it was only used for recruits when they were going through the academy. And there was a more limited set of exercises they were doing with the scenarios that didn't have as much of an emphasis on understanding what types of cognitive biases might be at play, or debriefing extensively afterward about different possibilities for how the scenario could have gone.
Okay. So why might we expect, or why did you and your colleagues expect this training to affect outcomes like discretionary arrests and use of force? Walk us through the potential mechanisms you had in mind.
Our conjecture was the training is going to make officers more deliberative. So instead of using, you know, default thinking and going with the first thing that comes to mind, they were going to be better able to systematically consider alternative possibilities for the situations they were encountering. And this was going to allow them to diagnose the situation better and then tailor their actions better to the particular needs of the situation. And our conjecture was this was going to allow them to resolve some of these situations without defaulting to using force or defaulting to making an arrest that might not be necessary.
And so as part of the what's going on here is that you said, you know, initially they come up with just a list of like what their triggers are. Is part of this also about like just recognizing when emotions or an emotional reaction is likely to get the better of them? And then kind of, and that is when they should be trying to be thinking about these thinking traps. Is that how we should be thinking about this?
I think that is a critical element of the training, is helping them recognize that emotions like stress or anger or irritation might interfere with their ability to think clearly in a particular situation. And so as a part of the overall steps that are taken as a part of what we call the thinking tactic model that's emphasized in the training, in fact, there's an element of what we call tactical breathing, where the idea is to take 3 to 5 deep breaths to activate and unlock proactive thinking so that you're not letting the emotions like the anger or the stress actually guide your decision making. So I would say that being able to engage in that type of emotion regulation was also a critical part of the training.
Okay. So this is, I mean, the first test of any program like this that I know of in policing, correct me if I'm wrong, but there has, as you said, there has been other work on cognitive behavioral therapy for other groups that we typically think of as high risk, especially like teens or people in prison or people at risk of criminal justice involvement. So before this paper, what had we known about the effectiveness of these kinds of programs outside of policing?
Yeah, as I mentioned at the beginning, so we knew from a randomized control trial of the Becoming a Man intervention in Chicago that CBT could be leveraged to curb automatic thinking in youth. And this could lead to dramatic reductions in youth participation in violent crime. And a finding along these lines was also shown in an evaluation of the STYLE program in a very different context in Monrovia, Liberia. Now, the BAND study additionally documented that not only could a CBT-type training keep youth from engaging in crime, but it also could keep them in school longer and prevent them from dropping out of high school, for example. So what BAM did is really establish the notion of curbing automatic thinking broadly. And we really kind of build on this general mechanism by positing a more specific mechanism through which reductions in automatic thinking could reshape officer behavior, which hones in on this idea of, you know, considering a wider range of possible explanations and alternatives.
I'll link in the show notes to an interview I did with William Arbour, who also has a really interesting recent paper on CBT programs in prisons in Canada. So yeah, I think we're learning more and more about the effects of CBT and the really beneficial effects of CBT, but it's new to apply this to policing, which is sort of amazing. I often half joke, half am serious that all of us would be better off if we had a therapist, but just imagine if, you know, everyone who is in really high risk, high stress jobs like this had a therapist and had this kind of resource and training. So why don't we know more? Why hasn't this happened before? Why don't we know more about the effects of police trainings in general on police outcomes, but also, you know, specific trainings like this? What makes all of this so difficult to study?
Yeah, I really see two challenges. You know, the first is the way in which trainings typically get introduced really make it very difficult usually for us to figure out what their true causal effect is. Right. So, you know, imagine a training gets introduced into a police department right when things are going really poorly, like when uses of force are rising. Or imagine that trainings also get targeted to officers who face the greatest challenges, who might exhibit the highest levels of force. Well, you know, if that's how training gets rolled out, then if we just look at the impact of training on use of the force, we might observe, if anything, that training appears to increase these types of adverse outcomes. But of course, that would just be a correlation and not the true impact of the training. I think the second challenge is about data. To really discern the effect of these things, you need really good data on officer level outcomes, on things like uses of force or arrests, but you know, for a training like ours, even how the mechanisms that we have in mind are changing, for example, as manifest potentially in like how officers are doing in simulators. And that is usually very difficult to access.
Yeah, often these police training studies will just like do a survey of people afterwards or something like that. And what we really want to know is how do they behave on the job? So what I love about your paper is you look at a whole range of outcomes, including what people actually do on the job out in the field to give us a sense of what this training is affecting. So as you said, you work with the Chicago Police Department to implement and test this training program. So how did you roll this out in a way that enabled you to measure the causal impact of receiving this SIT-D training?
We actually rolled the training out through a randomized controlled trial. So CPD agreed to randomize which officers would receive the training. So we started with a pool of, you know, 2,070 officers, and we literally used a lottery to randomly select the half who would be in the trained group while the other half served as a comparison control group. And so that really allowed us to cleanly get around some of the problems we were just talking about of what happens if training gets targeted to certain types of officers.
Yeah, the ideal gold standard, as they say, design that is so easy to hope for and so difficult to implement in practice. So give us a little bit more backstory on how this partnership came about and how you all pulled this off. Was the Chicago PD immediately on board with both the new training idea and implementing it as an RCT? I imagine there was some conversation that had to happen to convince them of both of these pieces.
So
give us some of that backstory. I know there are people both from practitioners who are might be interested in doing something like this and are wondering how to work with researchers, but also researchers wondering how to persuade their local police department to try something like this. So how did you persuade the Chicago PD to engage in this study?
Yeah, so this is an interesting story. We firstly worked with a really dedicated team at the University of Chicago Crime Lab for this project, which amongst its many strengths is that it had really strong ties to the leadership of various police departments, including CPD. Now, at the time, the superintendent at CPD was Eddie Johnson, and he immediately, but conditionally, was supportive of the idea in the sense that he said, I'd be happy to do this training, but you're going to have to convince the leadership at the training academy that this is a training that is going to be helpful. So we turned to the academy. We faced considerable uncertainty in, you know, how they might respond. And it turned out the leaders of the academy were true visionaries and really dedicated to police reform. So this included Commander Daniel Godsell, Lieutenant Jack Benigno, who were our first points of contact. Now, they actually found the idea we were putting forward to be very intuitive, and they could see how this would be helpful to officers and community members alike. But at the same time, a training like this really hadn't been done before, yet they were willing to take a risk on something different because they were forecasting that this was going to be helpful. And to them, it was actually a plus that we planned to do a data-driven evaluation precisely because the training was new. So in some sense, we were doubly lucky that they could both forecast the value of the training, but that they also valued the notion of evidence and evidence-based policy.
That's fantastic. So in this kind of scenario, Do police officers just do what they're told? And so if the leadership says we're doing a randomized trial and you're selected and you're not, everyone just is on board? Or is there some, confusion and persuasion that has to happen among the ranks as well?
So the wonderful thing about, CPD being fully on board with this training is that they rolled it out as one of their trainings. And so as with any other training that CPD does, when an officer is assigned to go to training that is considered a mandatory requirement on their part. And CIT-D being a CPD training, you know, was exhibited the same criteria. Now in Chicago, even if you are assigned to go to training, district commanders sometimes have the ability to sort of cancel you out of training if they have extreme needs in the department. So it isn't perfect in terms of compliance. And again, that's true for any training that CPD does. But in terms of sort of, you know, how the training was rolled out and how it evolved, I would be lying if I said it was all smooth sailing. And I think it's actually interesting to understand how this evolved. So, you know, as happens in bureaucracies, effective leaders sometimes get moved. And so our visionary leaders of the academy were actually moved to other departments. And so by the time we actually started the training, we did a train the trainers model. And by the time we actually got into the first train the trainers session, the folks we were working with at the academy who would be delivering the training actually had no idea what the training was about. And our starting point, I think, would be fair to characterize as a complete disaster. So we went into this session talking about cognitive demands, force option simulators, and they basically reacted with some combination of, we have no idea what you're talking about. And some of them, you know, were older and hadn't actually gone through the force option simulators at the academy themselves. And they said, and by the way, what is a FOSS? and then secondly, they said, are you here to Monday morning quarterback us? Because that's not going to work very well. So that was a really humbling experience. And we kind of had to back it up and provide an overview of what we were aiming for to the trainers. And the incredible thing is, when we actually got into the content, they then actually very quickly understood what the training was trying to achieve and how it was going to help officers navigate these situations and end up being beneficial, not just for community members, but the officers themselves. So then they helped us revise the curriculum. So through Train the Trainer, they helped us iterate on the curriculum so it was very relevant to CPD and would be taken well by the officers. And then these trainers, who were initially a bit skeptical, quickly became, and I'd say remain, the strongest advocates of the training. And ultimately, they obviously did a really amazing job delivering the training, because afterward, through anonymous course evaluations that the officers filled out, you know, those evaluations showed that 90% said they liked or really liked the training a lot, and over 93% said they would find it useful for the job. And we actually took this as high praise, because a lot of officers really do not like training and they call it death by PowerPoint. So we were very happy that thanks to the great trainers, we actually escaped that verdict.
Yeah, it's super interesting. It makes me think that, you know, one concern with some programs and the concern people might have of this one is that you are able to convince particularly charismatic or visionary leaders or trainers to do this, but not every place has trainers like that. And so the fact that you were kind of, that was the start of the story, but the people who actually wound up implementing this were not immediately on board and were not, you know, maybe unusual in that way. And so gives us a bit more confidence that this could be effective in other places too. And it's not something special about the trainers, as good as these trainers, I'm sure were.
Yeah, because the trainers are great, but they are a diverse group. And So if on average you can work with a diverse group to get a training well delivered, I think that is very promising.
Yeah. So when you talk about death by PowerPoint, I wonder, could you say a little bit more about what typical trainings are? Like, what are the other things that the Chicago PD is usually pulling officers out to train them in?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the trainings that CPD offers, I mean, there's over 120 different classes that, you know, even that officers are taking over this period. And so they come in many different flavors. So some of them are really focused on explaining what policy is, right? So what's in policy, what's out of policy, like a large component of, say, uses of force policy might focus or emphasize that element. There's also things like crisis intervention training, which is dealing with particular populations, like how should officers interact with those who are having a mental break, or, you know, those types of situations. then there are a set of trainings that more, you know, probably fall less into the death by PowerPoint category and that do leverage some kind of scenario-based training. So for example, there's dynamic room entry, where officers are going in and, you know, kind of learning how to clear hallways and enter into rooms in ways that don't endanger themselves. So those trainings are focused on tactics, but often the emphasis is on physical tactics. And so what we are sort of bringing to the table is an emphasis on this cognitive tactics.
Right. Yes. And that also is a flag that what you're measuring is the effect of your training kind of on top of all the usual training that everyone would receive anyway. So this is not like instead of other trainings, it's in addition. Okay. So let's talk about the data. So you've got this new training program. You've been working with the trainers to iterate on it. You're ready to go. You're going to roll it out as a randomized controlled trial. What data are you going to have to measure all of the effects of this?
So we use two data sources. About 4 months after the training, we brought all the officers in both the control group and the trained group back into the academy and had the trained personnel at CPD actually administer a series of N-line assessments where officers were being run through scenarios. And the information from this is going to help us get at mechanisms. And besides these N-line assessments, we also leverage CPD's own administrative data to be able to see what's happening out in the field in terms of officer behavior in the field.
So what outcome measures are you most interested in here?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're interested in the N-line assessments because they help us discern and shed light on the mechanism. But ultimately, what we really want to see is change in behavior out in the field. And from that angle, we have, you know, kind of two main outcomes from the administrative data that we're very interested in. One is uses of force. So we can't look at lethal force incidents because, you know, there's 8 such incidents or something like that in our sample over this focal period, 4 months after the training.
So they're just too few, too many, you know, in some ways, but too few statistically to be able to say anything about.
From a statistical angle, we wouldn't be statistically sort of powered to be able to look at the effects on lethal force outcomes, but we can look at uses of non-lethal force, which range from everything like use of tasers, OC spray, punching, kicking, baton, everything else. So that's our first kind of critical adverse policing outcome. And the second one is we actually pre-classified a set of arrests as discretionary. These are for charges like obstruction or disobeying an officer or disorderly conduct. They're arrests that officers often make because they're irritated or frustrated with subject behavior, and they may not be the best way of necessarily resolving a situation.
Okay, so let's get into the results. What do you find is the effect of the training on various N-line assessments and simulator exercises?
In the N-line assessments, we really see that the training transformed how officers navigate these situations in the sense that the trained officers are much better equipped to consider alternative interpretations of the situations they're in. So, for example, they consider a wider range of motivation behind subject behavior. They notice and recall more features of scenes when they're showed photos of crime scenes, for example. But at the same time, they actually make decisions faster about what they think is going on, which is consistent with the idea that they're actually processing information more efficiently because they're taking in more information and able to decide more quickly. In addition, we actually see that they update their responses more as the situation changes. So for example, if the subject in the situation becomes less threatening, they're more likely than the comparison group to recognize that they should now use a lower level of force. Now, in the simulators, we also see a number of shifts. We see that the trained officers are more likely to give verbal direction to the subjects and less likely to freeze. And they're also more likely to shoot when appropriate, which is driven by them being more likely to shoot when the subject represents a direct threat. So this latter finding is important because it suggests that this is not a training that keeps officers from taking action when action is actually needed in the situation.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think a lot of people think of these trainings as being prescriptive and telling people what to do. And as you mentioned earlier, this is much more about, let's help you think more clearly so that you can use these, you know, the tools in your toolkit in the way that's most appropriate and not, exactly, not in ways you might regret later.
So you can fine tune your actions to, mm-hmm, the needs of the situation.
Yeah. Okay. So those effects are super promising. So what was the effect on discretionary arrests and use of force when these officers went out in the field?
So out in the field, we find that the training led to a 23% reduction in uses of force, and similarly, about a 23% reduction in discretionary arrest.
Amazing. Those are big effects.
They are.
And then you also were able to look at other things. So tell us what the effect of SITD training was on policing outcomes like activity. Like, were police just more or less, or were they less likely to actually interact with civilians? And that's why arrests and use of force went down. So you can look at that. And then you also are interested in what happens to the officers in terms of their own safety. So injuries on the job. So tell us about the effects on those outcomes.
Yeah, we looked at officer activity exactly for the reason that you highlight is, you know, you might be worried that a training like this is making them somehow like generally less active, right? But what we did to look into that is we have a measure, an overall index of officer activity that looks at 12 different types of things officers do. This ranges from recovered guns, traffic stops, street stops, to parking citations. And we don't find any change in this outcome. So in other words, this is not a training that's making officers generally less active. The other big worry here is that, you know, if you're reducing these enforcement actions, is it somehow putting the officer in harm's way? So to look into this, we are able to measure effects on days off taken for injury. And we actually find that the training leads to a 49% reduction in days off taken for officer injury. So in other words, the reductions in the adverse policing outcomes that we're observing go hand in hand with improvements in officer safety.
That's a really cool result. So how long did all of these effects last?
So we don't have a very statistically precise answer to this question. Okay, I'd say overall, it appears that the effects are strongest in the first 4 months after the training and sort of diminish there afterward. But what I mean that we don't have a very statistically precise answer to this question is that after the first 4 months, the effects in subsequent intervals, like 5 to 8 months after the training, 9 to 12 months after the training, those effects we can't really say from a statistical angle are significantly different from the effects in the first 4 months after the training. But overall, kind of looking at the magnitudes of these effects over these different intervals, I would say it really looks like the effects are strongest in the first 4 months and appear to fade out subsequently.
Okay. So yeah, I think you say in the paper, this suggests, you know, some refresher trainings are probably a good idea, which makes sense for a skill like this, especially if it's a new skill that people are learning. And just remind me, so the headline results, those 23% reductions in arrests and use of force, that was within what time period?
That was within the first 4 months after the training.
4 months. Okay, great. Okay. And so was there any interesting variation in the training program's effects across different groups of officers or different groups of civilians, anything like that?
I would highlight two. So we examined whether the effects on arrests vary based on subject race, we actually found really substantial differences. So it turns out that, you know, the training, for example, reduces the arrests of Black subjects overall by 11%, but has no significant effects on the arrests of subjects of other races. And this disjuncture is even larger for discretionary arrests. So there's like a 28% reduction in the discretionary arrests of Black subjects without any corresponding reduction in the discretionary arrests for subjects of other races. And this we found really interesting because the training was not focused on implicit bias. It was focused on these more general cognitive biases. And yet it seems that, you know, training officers to navigate these general biases better and training them to become more deliberative enables some closing of the race gap in arrest rates and improves racial disparities and critical outcomes.
Which is especially interesting given that that wasn't, again, like it wasn't the prescriptive, it wasn't something that this program was necessarily trying to do, but by helping officers think more clearly and approach situations kind of with more clarity and deliberateness, that was a happy additional result.
Exactly, exactly. We weren't sure going into it if we would necessarily observe effects on these racial disparities.
Yeah.
The second heterogeneous effect that I think is interesting actually is on the officer side. And we find that the effects are actually larger for officers who have less years of experience. So like if you consider an officer who's been on the job 3 years versus 10 years, the effects are actually twice as large for those less experienced officers. And you know, we think this is consistent with the idea that it's actually the younger officers who face greater need. They tend to have higher rates of uses of force and discretionary arrests than their more experienced counterparts. So in some ways, the training, you know, is providing a larger impact for those who might face the greatest needs.
So what are the policy implications of these results? What should policymakers and practitioners out there take away from your study?
I think what's really exciting about the study is that the results show that officers are really malleable with respect to a training like this. So training them to navigate these cognitive demands can actually reshape their behavior in ways that have really substantial impact. So one direct policy implication is to invest in this type of training. Now, of course, departments face budget constraints, right? But one advantage of this training also is its cost effectiveness. So we actually estimate the cost of CID to be similar to the cost of other trainings that use this type of force option simulator technology. But we also estimate that in CID's case, this cost is actually outweighed by the cost savings from just one of the outcomes, which is from reduced officer injuries. And that doesn't even take into account the broader and more diffuse possible benefits to community members from reduced uses of force and greater trust in policing and the like. So in some sense, even just focusing on one outcome, the officer injuries, suggests that the training could pay for itself. The other aspect of budget constraints is that departments often have to choose between different types of trainings. So earlier when we were talking about, you know, what are the different trainings that CPD does, you know, you could do crisis intervention training, you can do de-escalation training, you can do implicit bias training, and you may not be able to do it all. I think what's interesting about a training like this is if you're able to provide some generalized skills that help officers navigate these situations more broadly, it could be helpful in a variety of these situations. And you can even tailor the training to, you know, emphasize particular needs the department might have in a given time by selecting scenarios and situations that are particularly relevant to that department. And the final thing I'll say on policy implications is if you're setting out to close the race gap in some critical outcomes, you know, as I mentioned before, some literature reviews of implicit bias trainings and policing contexts have essentially shown limited impacts on behavior in the field. So training officers to become more generally deliberative might be a different route to achieving that outcome.
Excellent. Yeah, I think there's so much potential here. I know you're also looking for other police departments to work with to potentially replicate the study, to just try to move toward a version of this training that we're all confident is scalable and has the same effects everywhere or, you know, in more places. So is it safe to say that if folks who are listening are interested in trying this in their own city, they should get in touch?
Absolutely. We are very enthusiastic to do another iteration of this training, which could be a replication, but we also have some ideas for how to iterate on the training in ways that might deliver even larger impacts. So we'd be very enthusiastic to work with other police departments on this.
Ooh, very exciting. Okay, so that is all your paper. Have any other papers related to this topic come out since you all first started working on this study?
I think there's been a number of papers that really shed light on kind of officer behavior. They're not necessarily about training. So for example, you know, Bokhar Ba, Roman Rivera, and Justin Hulse have done some work that shows that peers really matter for these types of outcomes. In their 2023 paper, they show, you know, if you are working with a peer from a police academy who is injured on duty, this leads to subsequent increases in your tendency to use force in the next week. So their work really highlights how peers matter a lot. There's also been really interesting work on the role of field training officers by Adger, Roth, and Sloan, where they're showing, you know, if officers worked with a field training officer or FTO who tended to use force excessively, then officers subsequently themselves tend to use force excessively down the lines. And I think these results are very interesting because they can really help us think about how to design future iterations of a SIT-D type training as well.
And what is the research frontier? What are the next big questions in this area that you and others will be thinking about in the years ahead?
Yeah, so I think some of them actually have to do with, you know, what could training like this achieve if it were targeted in a different way or rolled out in a different way. So a question building directly on the Adger Ross Sloan work is, what happens if you target SIT-D to field training officers, right? Then maybe that ends up, you know, influencing a whole bunch of other officers who they're subsequently training. Similarly, what happens if you train a whole team of people, since, you know, peers seem to matter for the work of Bokhar Ba, Roman Rivera, and Justin Hulse? Imagine, you know, that there are spillover effects where untrained officers reduce the effectiveness of the training. So now what happens if you actually treat a whole team of people with the training? Can this help to sustain the effects over time? And once you start, you know, thinking about training whole teams, you can begin to think about targeting the training so everyone in a geographic region gets trained. And if all officers in a particular geographic region, like a district, get trained, you can begin to even think about additional outcomes, like, does this change community members' perceptions of the legitimacy of policing and the extent to which they cooperate more with police? And you can begin to answer those types of questions as well. So that is sort of, you know, what could lie ahead in terms of iterating on this type of training. But I would also, you know, step back and say, today we've talked a lot about policing, but I think there are many other professions where people are navigating these high stress situations inside the criminal justice system and outside. And I think it would be really interesting to think about potentially offering training along these lines that help other types of workers and other types of professionals think differently about the situations they're in. And this could have, you know, really important downstream impacts on productivity and decision-making across a range of different contexts.
My guest today has been Oandrila Dubé from the University of Chicago. Oandrila, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
You can find links to all the research we discussed today on our website, probablecausation.com. You can also subscribe to the show there or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you don't miss a single episode. Big thanks to Emergent Ventures and our other contributors for supporting the show. Probable Causation is produced by Doliak Initiatives, a 501c3 nonprofit. If you enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. This helps others find the show, which we very much appreciate. Our sound engineer is John Kerr, with production assistance from Nefertari El-Sheikh. Our music is by Werner, and our logo was designed by Carrie Throckmorton. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon.